This is the Cubs-related podcast. Corey and I are talking to you on a Sunday evening. This podcast will discuss the MVP, Manager of the Year, and Cy Young results. And depending on where it goes, we may talk about some of the soon-to-be off-season moves, and we'll go from there. Corey, how are we doing?
Well, the Cubs won the World Series a few weeks ago, so still good.
I am currently wearing my World Series championship hats, and I told you the story today, but it might make some other people laugh. I went to a deli this morning, and at this deli, they give out, instead of table numbers, so those working there know where to bring food, they give out sports logos. And so I'm wearing my Cubs hat. And it's the World Series championship hat. And the guy looks at me, and he like stares at my hat for a good like 5 seconds. So I know he's looking at it. And then he's searching for something underneath the register. I'm like, what is this guy doing? And he goes ahead and he gives me a St. Louis Cardinals tabletop and just chuckles. And it was a moment of mutual understanding. And at that moment, it was great. The Cubs finally had the Cardinals number. And I'm assuming the guy was a Cardinals fan. If not, he was just trying to make me laugh. But it was very satisfying, Corey. And
all the years of anguish and despair, all worth it for that one moment in a deli in Los Angeles.
Now, I don't know about you, but I've probably watched the last out of the World Series every day since they actually won that game. It's like a dopamine boost for me. It's like a drug right now at this point. So if you need a pick me up during the day, just go on YouTube, watch that last out, and I guarantee you that you will feel much better.
Well, and there's just so much content now, and I think it's really fascinating. You know, there's just so many different versions of, you know, compilations and highlight videos and stuff. I know I was watching one the other night that was, you know, like a condensed version of all the highlights, you know, pro Cubs, like for the entire playoffs. So yeah. It was basically, you know, just like the good portions of every single game. I think it was like an hour long, but what an hour it was.
There was a, yeah,
it doesn't really get old. I mean, this is coming from someone who I used to have I still have it, but I used to watch the double play that Jose Hernandez grounds into when the Cubs win the division in 2003.
It's the best.
I have it on VHS, and I used to watch that, I think, you know, like every night before bed for a good while. So, I'm definitely a glutton for these highlight videos.
There was a recent video that came out today. I don't know if you saw it. But some guy compiled every single Cubs homer this year. I think there were 220 of them.
Yeah,
so it's funny.
That was a good time.
Yeah, it's funny how Miggy ended up hitting the first homer, and then he ended up hitting the last homer of the season. I thought that was funny. But let's get into the MVP voting and all the awards.
Let's go in order that they did. So Manager of the Year first.
So they vote before the postseason starts, in case
our
listeners don't know. And so some people were making the argument, well, Joe Maddon didn't really manage the best in the postseason. That might be true, depending how you look at it, but that doesn't factor into the voting. So those baseball writers determined that Dave Roberts was the most valuable manager of the year. And I'm not going to sit here and bash it, but you know, Joe Maddon, he won 103 games with his squad. Not only that, Schwarber went down, and the Cubs have a lot of youth. And to maximize the production out of a young core like that, all while putting them in situations that might not be the most comfortable, for example, having Baez essentially play every position in the infield and having Bryant go to third, left, right. Not only were these players able to develop offensively, but he also allowed them to grow into several different defensive positions. And I know we talk about the bullpen change in the game that we're seeing right now where managers are using their best arms a little bit earlier in the game, no other manager is doing what Madden is doing, and having several young talented players play all over the diamond. So I thought Madden was deserving just because of that. I don't know what your feelings are. And I really do love Dave Roberts, nothing against him, but I was a little surprised to see Madden not get it.
Yeah, I don't think I didn't really have that big of a problem with it. I kind of assumed that that was the direction that was going to go even beforehand. And I think you could make an argument on either side. I mean, I think the first thing I'm inclined to think is that a manager of a team with the payroll such as the Dodgers almost should be like excluded from the voting. That being said, they dealt with a lot of injuries. He also was able to bring up some younger guys and utilize them and allow them to have an environment to succeed. Obviously, you're not giving him credit for Corey Seager being Corey Seager, but a manager does deserve credit when a guy is called up at that age and with that kind of hype, and he's able to, solidify a role and kind of do it seamlessly. The Urias thing is an interesting thing to be dealing with as a manager. And obviously they're without Clayton Kershaw amongst many, a litany of other injuries. So I certainly see the merit for Dave Roberts, but it is one of those things where I look at it and I go, a team with what do they have, a $300 million payroll? Like, okay, they ought to be in the playoffs. I'm not sure how much I want to reward them for doing that. But yeah, I mean, I didn't really have a problem with it, because by the same token, you can argue that, Madden's obviously coming in with a very good team. And, I suppose the writers gave him credit for all that you were just saying a year ago. So perhaps they, don't look upon it as, as much of an
As
accomplishment
novel,
this
yeah.
time. Yeah,
I think
which,
Dave
you know,
Roberts was a
and
little bit more of a novelty effect, given that
sure.
this
And
was
he's
his
a,
first
and
year.
he was a, and I don't know if you mentioned this in your intro of it, but, Robert's obviously a first year manager. So to be able to do everything he did, and I think, part of it too, and a good argument that I saw kind of in the pro Roberts camp was just, to kind of look at the way he navigated it and the things that he was able to accomplish, and kind of maybe wondering if you really thought that Don Mattingly would have been able to produce the same result. And I think a lot of people came to the conclusion that perhaps he wouldn't have been able to. So, yeah, I didn't really have a problem with it. I think we're all a little biased at this point,
Oh,
but
we're all biased.
I do think that what you said about kind of the positional versatility, whether or not you want to give him the manager of the year award, I still think that like somehow doesn't like still doesn't get enough play
It
in
doesn't.
the media and throughout all this other stuff. I mean, it really is nuts,
That's right.
the way that he was doing that. And I think by the time we get to the World Series, everybody's kind of accustomed to it, but the fact that Chris Bryant was playing everywhere, Baez was playing everywhere, Zobrist is playing everywhere,
Contreras
Joe
even was
Madden's
playing
using
everywhere.
three catchers. Yeah, I mean, I think that the argument for Madden goes beyond, just winning 103 games and doing what he did, in history and all that other stuff with the Cubs. And I don't know that that got kind of enough credit, for Madden, but yeah, I didn't really have a problem with Roberts winning it, and at the end of the day, I think it's a lot more humorous or something that Madden beats both manager of the year winners in Dave Roberts and Terry Francona. So, and it's sort of the same conclusion you reach with the Cy Young voting, where we got the trophy that we wanted, so we can literally let the people we beat, have their consolation prize, if you will. So,
Yeah, before we go on and talk about the Cy Young, I do want to ask you this question, and I've seen a lot of people, probably the majority of people I come across, really dislike how Madden managed in the playoffs. And I don't know if we talked about this a lot.
I think we did a little.
Okay. And when people talk about Madden's performance in the playoffs, they particularly talk about Game 6 and Game 7. And I think we can talk about that too, but just overall, Corey, what do you think was his overall effect during the playoffs? Are you a little bit disappointed how he went about the process, or did you like most of his moves? I know I'm
I
throwing
I,
you on the
I certainly,
spot.
I no. I mean, I certainly found myself disagreeing with a variety of things. I think mostly bullpen usage. Not really anything else, I don't think. Although, I do remember when we were at the game together, the not pinch hitting for Hayward in. I'm kind of blanking on the
It was the
scenario. I know there was a, what
sixth
is that,
inning
one
of.
in the 1-0 Kershaw game,
Yeah,
right?
that was game two of the NLCS. Yeah.
And yeah, just not kind of I think we it's like kind of a spot for maybe Soler or whatever the situation was, but yeah, I mean I certainly questioned, I felt like I questioned more of his decisions in the playoffs than any time throughout these last 2 years. But I think that's also kind of a, he's sort of a victim of his own success in that regard, where we've seen him successfully deploy so many different strategies and using different players in different situations and stuff like that. And he kind of created the, the kind of monster himself, where most teams there's, there's not this many answers to a question, or there's not this many solutions to a problem. And the way that Madden managed and the kind of versatility and flexibility that he asked of and received from his players sort of creates the ability for us as fans to look at basically any situation and second guess it, because there might be a different answer, So yeah, I mean I it's one of those things where I only the and I think we've talked about this before, but certainly something that you gather is a pretty popular opinion amongst people that work in baseball, and in just that, you kind of just ask the manager to go out there and not screw up the roster that you're kind of providing him, and to make informed decisions. And I believe that's what Madden does. I believe that when he does things, he's doing it because he believes in the process, not the result. And sometimes I might have a different view of that, but it's one of those things where I trust him overall and really sort of implicitly. And I didn't have that big of a problem with anything he did. I certainly think game seven is one of those games that if it goes a different way, I'm not, I think this conversation's different, because I think it's a lot easier to look at, the usage of Chapman in game six, when he took Lester and Hendricks out in that
Sure.
game seven, and stuff like that, and sort of nitpick it. But I mean I didn't particularly have any issue with most of what was going on. And namely, like I know he got a lot of flack, and he'll probably continue to get a lot of flack for just Chapman usage as a whole, like throughout all of the rounds. And really only in that last game, the last two games, that I have an issue with it. I think he used him as a weapon and used him in a, we need to end this game now kind of, and I didn't have an issue with it. So overall, yeah, I certainly had some questions, and there were certainly some decisions that I would have loved, for a more expanded discussion or explanation on, but overall I'm pro Madden, so.
Yeah. Overall, like you, I thought he did pretty fine in the playoffs as a whole. A lot of people point to Game 6 and Game 7 as reasons why he didn't have a good postseason. But then again, what also doesn't get much attention is, I guess, his emotional touch on this roster. And what I mean by that is, I don't know what he saw, but he was able to put Baez in a position in the batting order where that really came through to our benefit. Same with Contreras. You look back to those later San Francisco games and the early Dodger games. Obviously, Baez won the NLCS MVP, but he batted Baez continuously in the upper part of the order as the postseason went along. And then once he sensed that Baez was expanding his zone, he had no issue dropping him back down into the order and then swapping him with Russell. So it was almost like the Cubs were able to identify Russell's slump, drop him in the order, identify Baez's slump, drop him in the order, but at the same time, identify when they're seeing the ball well and put them up in the order. And I really, really did like that. I thought it was pretty ballsy to have Schwarber bat second.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, I think he deserves more credit for that move.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I didn't even mention that. And that's something, too, that is, I think, very typical of the media in general, that they were all over it when the decision was being talked about. Like, is this crazy? Is this, you know, I remember Pete Rose saying it was nuts. Everybody saying it was totally nuts. And it certainly wasn't nuts. And I remember what we said at the time was, if they're doing it, it's because they believe it's going to work. There's right. No way that Theo and Jed and Joe are looking at this going, you know, oh, it's a good story, or we hope it works out. It's like they're doing it because they genuinely believe he's going to get up there and do what he did. And I think you're right. I don't think, you know, we got the same kind of, it kind of turned more to Schwarber, you know, like he's the story and what an amazing guy, and deserved, you know, deservedly so. But I do think we kind of skipped the part where, you know, the Cubs brass and the medical staff, right, who got him ready and like actually pulled that off. So yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, I think that is definitely.
How scary was the Cubs' state of the bullpen throughout the entire postseason?
Sure. Yeah, that's another one too. I think, you know, now that it's all over, really not until it's over do you kind of realize that, okay, like clearly they saw stuff and the trust level in Strope and Rondon was not what we all might have thought it was throughout this whole process.
Definitely.
Which, you know, again, makes it just sort of incredible that he was able to navigate that and get it done. And, you know, another thing too, that he's the one, well, not, I mean, you know, we never know if it's only him, but, you know, this is something that we talked about all through the year, where building that lead in the division and being in the spot that they were throughout the entire season was so important because it let them play around. And it's to those of us that were watching the entire year, was anybody really that surprised or nervous or anything to see Carl Edwards pitching in that, you know, in that game 7 of the World Series? Of course, it's not the way you draw it up, right? But, yeah, you know, if you had been watching all year, you know, no, I mean, Madden's been throwing him out there in spots like this all the time, you know, and he, you know, he should be ready for this. You know, right. Joe has shown the trust in him. He's gotten experience, obviously not in situations of that magnitude, but, you know, it wasn't something where it's like, oh my God, we're throwing a, you know, a long reliever out there who's never pitched in high leverage situations. No, it's like Carl had been out there.
That's a great point too, because we're looking even in August, and look, I'll be the first one to say, like, I was not thrilled to see Madden use Chapman in the 8th inning of a mid-August game.
Mm-hmm.
And now that we go back and look, really it was a priming decision. What I mean by that is, it's, you put someone in a simulation, so to speak. So when a situation...
Are you going like all psychological on us here?
I might be going all psychological. I apologize. But it's like, it's like preparing for an exam, right? You study, study, study. So you hope and pray that you're ready for when the exam actually comes. And so in the same analogy, I think Madden gave the Cubs a lot of practice problems throughout later in the season.
Yeah.
And especially Carl Edwards Jr. And the kid is a pretty emotional dude. I've been actually friends on Facebook with him for, like, I think 4 or 5 years now. And he's, I mean, in that San Francisco series, I don't know if you saw this, but he was just doing like a periscope in the outfield bleachers in San Fran in game 3 before the game mm-hmm. even started. And he's just sitting there for 30 minutes, like, talking about how this is like one of the best moments of his life and how he hopes he's in a high leverage situation with the bases loaded that he wants to strike him out. And so, like, Edwards is a pretty juiced up dude. So I'm not surprised he was thrown in that moment. I was a little bit scared because I know the
Sure.
emotions can get the best of him, and his first World Series appearance wasn't the strongest. But the point I'm making, and circle back to what you were saying, is Maddon gave Edwards several chances to mentally prepare himself for a situation like that. Although it wasn't ideal to use him to win the World Series, I don't think anyone would have imagined that. Nevertheless, he put him in a situation where that was a possibility. And I think he deserves a lot of credit for that. And I don't know a lot of people talk. I don't know if a lot of people are actually realizing that.
Yeah. So overall, Joe Maddon, good. That's the summation here.
Now, in terms of Cy Young,
Wait,
yeah.
let me preface this
Got.
by saying if you kind of want to get in depth on Brendan's thoughts, you can check out the post he made. You can see it on CubsRelated.com or CubsInsider.com on both. A little, as Evan put it, a little cross pollination. But I do on here, I do want to interject, Brendan, not to get too angry or,
At
don't go
me?
too tangential on me here.
I'm
Yeah.
not. I
Well,
may,
I
I actually
just,
may,
because
depends
I
where you're
know how you
upset.
feel about it, and I and I'm just trying to preempt like an hour long rant for the listeners here.
I have self-control, Corey.
Okay. I
Although
don't believe you, but okay.
sometimes I have self-control. But anyway, the results were as expected for me. I thought Scherzer would win it, followed up by Lester and Hendricks. That's typically what I thought would happen, and it ended up happening like that. I don't know your feelings on it, but I do think that Scherzer deserved the Cy Young. But I also think Lester and Hendricks deserved it as well. But when looking at the overall portfolio of all these pitchers, although it was close, I think Scherzer had the upper hand, the strikeouts, the run prevention, all the other advanced metrics, whatever you want to use. I think he had the upper hand. I mean, what are
Yeah,
your feelings?
and he does, obviously I don't know how much it factors into the voting, but when a guy throws a 20 strikeout game, that's I think that probably carries some weight. I don't know if it should, but that's obviously a big accomplishment in this league. So I think there wasn't a wrong choice. I feel disappointed in that one. I think the mostly for Kyle Hendricks. I think that you almost kind of feel like as a league, with the kind of stats that we have and stuff like that, that perhaps we were. Yeah, it kind of sounds like election speak, where it's like I think as a nation we were ready for a Cy Young winner like Kyle Hendricks, but apparently, not quite. But yeah, I mean, I think that all of them, to me, it was, and it's weird because Lester ends up coming in second, just the way the voting shakes out. But to me, it was a Scherzer Hendricks battle, right? Because I think, if you're looking at the, Scherzer versus Lester, I think, you're kind of, maybe in a similar vein, but Scherzer just kind of blows everybody away with the strikeouts and stuff. But I think that everybody kind of had their own limitations, and everybody did a lot of things well. I know that a lot of people were pointing out that Max Scherzer was really not very good against left-handed hitters and really couldn't get them out. So that wasn't, that's not great. And certainly when you look at those numbers, it definitely kind of is like, all right, well, I'm not sure you can be the Cy Young when you. Are this poor against an entire side of the plate, but it's going to be the same thing when you turn it on Hendricks, where it's like I don't know if you can win the Cy Young without striking out X amount of guys, and so I really didn't have a problem with it, and Scherzer I think is one of those guys too who, and he had one of those starts against the Cubs, I believe in Washington, where he's just one of those guys where when he's on. He just has that presence on the mound, and kind of within the first few pitches, it's going to be a really long night for the offense. And so, yeah, I mean, I thought they were all bringing something to the table. They all did a ton well, and had a couple things you could nitpick as far as how they got there. But yeah, I mean, again, just sort of disappointed for Kyle was my overall sentiment. Just because you just never know when a guy like that is going to be that close to winning something like that. And I think it would have been really cool and different.
Right. He had, just to put all this into perspective so we can sort of figure out where we're going here. So Hendricks had a 2.13 ERA, number one in Major League Baseball. Max Scherzer had a 2.96 ERA, obviously not number one in baseball, but granted, top 10. Lester had a 2.44 ERA. He had a 3.41 FIP, which I think was to his detriment in some of the voting. Kyle Hendricks had a 3.20 FIP, which is actually lower than Max Scherzer's 3.24 FIP. Now, the difference between Scherzer and Hendricks is that Hendricks pitched 190 innings, whereas Scherzer pitched almost 229 innings. So we have almost about a 40-inning discrepancy. And I can see why writers voted for Scherzer because he provided 40 more innings of value, right? I don't disagree with that. But the reason I'm bringing all this up, and I wrote about this, so I'm not going to go off on a big tangent, but I think it's a good opportunity for discussion, is how should we weigh these advanced statistics like FIP or Sierra, for example? How should we weigh ERA? And how, to what extent should we pick and choose one to make an argument that a pitcher is better than his counterpart? And right now, I think just with this, the way modern baseball statistics are publicly, now remember, these are publicly available statistics. These are not what is driving front office decisions. I'd be very surprised if Theo Epstein is going on Fangraphs like what I'm doing right now, clicking on the FIP sorting button and trying to identify pitchers. Like, damn well he's not doing that, right? And so I think when we go on Fangraphs and we read all these justifications for why a pitcher deserves to win a Cy Young, I caution people to believe what some of these people say because Scherzer had, 500ths of a worse FIP than Hendricks. And so when we get into these decimal ranges of why a pitcher is better than the other with these advanced statistics, we should really understand the limitations to all these statistics, like FIP, like ERA, like Sierra. And I think once we do that, we can actually make better opinions and trust us as humans of what we're seeing. I don't know about you, Corey, but I watched every single Lester start this year. I'm sure you did as well. And I can tell you that although the Cubs probably did save a lot of runs, Lester was really, really, really good. And I don't think the Cubs bailed him out as much as a lot of people think he did. And the same goes for Hendricks. So there's my little rant. It was 2.5 minutes, Corey. Is that okay?
Yes.
Okay, I will stop
Very
there.
appropriate.
I will stop there. But do you know what I'm saying
I
now?
think well, and I think that's kind of sort of what I was getting at, where it's just like, when you have a mix of pitchers like this that are so different, you have a veteran lefty who, throws, kind of towards the lower end of the speed spectrum, but gets a ton of Ks and limits hard contact versus a young righty who is, throwing slow and getting absolutely no hard contact, but not really striking guys out. And then you throw in, a big power pitcher striking out guys left and right, blowing, kind of throwing more innings and stuff like that. It's just, that's, I think, what you're getting at. It's tough to really reconcile all of this data and decide kind of where you're putting the weight. And I think that's why a lot of people, disappointed as Cubs fans that, you have two guys in the race and neither of them win. But I really don't think that there was a bad decision. I do think that there are bad ways to reach any of the three decisions. You know, and I think you certainly see that on some where, you know, where Lester or Hendricks aren't even on certain ballots, which I think is
author top five. Yeah. It's
pretty absurd, you know, and how you arrive at that conclusion, I, you know, really don't know, but, I thought that was one where, you know, you really couldn't get it wrong. And no matter what, you were going to be giving it to a pitcher who had provided a ton of value for their team and, you know, certainly is warranted of being called the best pitcher in the league. So, and that, of course, takes us to the real award that matters here, which is the MVP award, which I think we all kind of knew wasn't really going to be very close, and it shouldn't have been. But, you know, you just never know with awards like this, as we were just talking about, you know, kind of the kind of randomness and how it's all decided, you know, you just never know. Because the one thing that, you know, before they got to it, I was thinking, man, you know, to me, like, one of the easiest justifications here for who should win this and why is that if Corey Seager doesn't show up and do what he did, I don't think the Dodgers make the playoffs.
Right, so we get into that argument of, well, Chris Bryant was really good, but they also had Rizzo, and they also had Fowler, and one of the best pitching staffs. Right.
Maybe not for sure, but it's like the Dodgers aren't making the playoffs if Seager doesn't show up, and he, you know, immediately is belting home runs and playing great defense and just, you know, kind of like what we saw with Chris Bryant last year when he, you know, also wins the Rookie of the Year, where it, you know, it takes like, what, a couple days, and they just settle into being lifelong major leaguers, getting in the middle of the order. You know, it looks like they've been there forever, you know, and that's how it was with Seager, and he didn't stop. And, you know, so I was just a little nervous before that one because I thought that, you know, if that had been the argument people were voting on, I don't know that I could have necessarily disagreed with it. And, you know, you get into the whole argument of exactly what is meant by valuable, right? And we saw that debate pretty hotly contested with the Mike Trout, Mookie Betts side of the award.
Yeah.
And for me, you know, and I don't know how you feel about this. I don't know how you as listeners feel about this, but it to me, you should give it to the best player. It is not Mike Trout's fault that the Angels stink. It's not Mike Trout's fault that the Angels don't know how to put a baseball team together. And he was very clearly the best player in the league. And that is what the MVP should be. And if that's not what it is, then it's a silly award because, you know, it's also one of those things where I never really understand that argument that it has to be from a contending team because the line of all that is going to be so thin, you know? And I think, you know, just to suggest that the Angels win what, like 60 games, 70 games, whatever they want. I mean, what do they win? Like 15 less if Trout isn't there?
Probably.
You know, who knows, right? You know, you just don't even know.
Right.
So, to me, it should just be the best player. So when we're looking at the NL, it's the same thing. It's like it should be Chris Bryant. He was the best player. Whatever argument you want to make about how good the Cubs would have been without him or anything like that, I don't think it matters. And I know the one person that didn't vote for him first, preventing him, of course, from being unanimous. One of the justifications that I saw him use on Twitter, it'll also, you know, I don't think it'll shock anyone that he's a Mets beat writer.
Oh, the guy who voted for Murphy?
Yeah, and so, you know, I don't think that surprises anybody, but one of the justifications I saw him use was that Murphy had a better OPS against teams above 500, which, you know, and this is what, you know, we were kind of talking about in that Cy Young thing where it's like, I don't think you can end up at the wrong result. I think your process for the voting can be wrong though. And that is an example of, it's just wrong. And when someone says that publicly, their vote should be taken away because there's so much wrong with that train of thought that it, I mean, we could almost do a whole podcast on why that doesn't make any sense, but just to highlight my kind of initial reaction to reading that, And I'll pose this question to you, Brennan, and you can, you know, maybe answer this for me. But I was under the impression that teams that are under 500 are also allowed to have good pitchers. Is that incorrect? It's only something I've heard.
Really? So, like, a player like Chris Sale is allowed to be good?
Right.
I did not know that.
But apparently, if you hit a homer off Chris Sale, it is not as impressive as hitting a homer off of, say, Bartolo Colon, or I don't know why I picked the Mets. We were talking about the Mets. It's not as impressive as hitting a home run off of Jerome Williams when he comes out of the St. Louis bullpen, because St. Louis is over 500 and the White Sox were not. So
I still have images of Jerome Williams playing for the Cubs with the what they call puka shells. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, the necklace.
Yeah, I don't know why I always think of that, but continue. Sorry.
Yeah, so it's just one of those things where I think that kind of response is indicative of the whole problem. It's just you have these guys voting on whatever they want, and that's pretty silly. Luckily this one wasn't that close, and I really don't think there's much of an argument for either Murphy or Seager. I do think the Dodgers not being a playoff team without Seager is certainly a strong one, but I don't think it at all. Moves the needle on whether or not the answer is Chris Bryant. And then when you hear people saying things like that, that his OPS is better against teams with over 500. I mean, it's absurd. I mean, and that's just absolutely absurd.
Not only does Chris Bryant hit the hell out of the ball, which we know he does, he had the second highest base running score in the National League this year.
Like seven different positions.
Exactly. And in that game seven, right, when Rizzo hit that double down the right field line,
Bryant scored on that. That's insane.
Also, he scored on that pop-up off of Russell's bat in game seven.
Yeah, Chris Bryant was on display in that game for sure.
For overall, I guess if you want to say five-tool player, everyone loves five-tool players. Chris Bryant meets every single check plus on that five-tool list, and then you can add a few points to each one of those check boxes. Like, he's exactly what you want in a player in every single category. So I think it should have been.
I think Chris Bryant is a six tool player because I think his beautiful blue eyes are a tool all unto themselves.
I know you were going
there. You knew that was coming, yeah.
Yep, I knew that was coming there. All right. I guess we can wrap up. I guess I'll just lay out the general outlook for the.
I do want to mention, in case you didn't see it, but make sure to go check out. We did a post about it, but, there's others as well about Ian Happ in the Arizona Fall League.
Yes.
Just in case you're a little, perturbed at, reading all this stuff about Gleyber Torres, who of course won the Arizona Fall League MVP.
Yeah, he's
and, is doing, I think, what everybody expected him to do. But if you're, a little annoyed about reading that, in the sense that the Cubs obviously traded him away to get Aroldis Chapman, go check out what Ian Happ did yesterday. And I think, because we were talking about it before, but like that is so indicative of, in the post that I did about it, I asked if you had ever heard the phrase embarrassment of riches. And that's really where we are, because not only does he go 4-for-4 in the AFL championship game yesterday, leading the Mesa team to the championship, but he hits two home runs, one from each side of the plate, right?
Mm-hmm.
He makes an excellent defensive play, and this is where it sort of all is really just laughable. He makes the play in left field, right? And mind you, he was drafted as a second baseman, and he's played the majority of his games in the minor leagues as a second baseman. So this is just another one, right? Coming up the pipeline where he's already ready for what Madden wants to do and what he's going to think about doing. And I don't know when we'll see Ian Happ. That'll certainly depend on where they start him next year and how he continues to develop. But, for a team that just won the World Series with what was the average age, like 24 and a half, something like that.
You throw out Ben Zobrist, and it's kind of
right.
Be
yeah, you take out
there.
Ross and Ben Zobrist, and it's like 24, 23, something along the line.
Whatever it is, it's still extremely well.
Right. So, you know, you're looking at that, and then you're also seeing stories like this about Ian Happ and what he's doing. Every time they were doing the exit velocities in the Arizona Fall League, Eloy Jimenez, number one, number two, number four, number five, like they all belong to him. So it's really a fascinating time to be a Cubs fan. And just, you know, if you're maybe, you know, looking for something else to watch or read about besides just replaying the entire playoffs of the 2016 season, which I do, you know, I have no problem with that. I'm right there with you. But there is actually, you know, more stuff coming somehow. We just seem to be keeping the train rolling here. So definitely check that out.
And we didn't even gush about Eloy Jimenez. I know you mentioned him quickly, but if you have not seen that guy hit a baseball, type his name in YouTube and just watch one of the many homers that he has hit. He has one of the smoothest swings, and he looks like Jorge Soler's size, and he strikes out at like a 16 to 17% rate. That is Anthony Rizzo from the right side. Just go look at him if you're bored and you're sick of watching.
Admire, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I shouldn't even say sick of. What am I saying? Sick of watching this playoff season? What am I even saying?
That's not the sick of isn't the right.
Why did I even? I'm embarrassed.
You know,
even
just
said
maybe
that.
Maybe looking for a little variety.
Right. So
because you've seen you know how many times? Let's be honest, Brendan. How many times can you watch Joe Blanton hang that slider to Miguel Montero? A million? You know, eventually it's like, come on, you know.
Maybe 2 million for me. I don't know about you. But yeah, so going into these next few weeks, and then we'll end it there. But I just want to set the perspective for where the Cubs are going to be going here. There are obviously a lot of free agent arms on the market in the bullpen. Looks like San Fran will indefinitely sign one of the big three. One of the big three being Jansen, Chapman, or Melanson.
Mm-hmm.
Recently, a report came out that the Cubs did their due diligence on Jansen, whatever that means. I know the Cubs are always looking at every single player on the market. Doesn't mean they're serious, but they still, you know, go do their homework. Also, I think the Dodgers will be pretty active this offseason. There was another report, and I say this because it does have some relevance to the Cubs, that the White Sox will be shopping most of their players who have less than or equal to 3 years of cost controllable playing time. So obviously the big one on that list would be Chris Sale. And they also have some young guys. And the Dodgers farm system appears to match up pretty well, where they could maybe in a blockbuster deal go and get someone like Chris Sale. But I wouldn't hold it past the Cubs to also be in that mix.
Check on it, yeah.
Yeah, I doubt the White Sox want to go ahead and give their rival in the same market their best player, and especially with the Cubs winning a World Series.
I don't know. I mean, I think, yeah, I agree, but I think the White Sox are in a position where I don't know that they can be that picky. They're in a rough spot right now. So. Yeah.
And in addition to those guys, Andrew Kashner just signed with Texas for a 1 year, $10 million contract. My opinion, fantastic deal for Texas. I've always liked Kashner. I think he has great stuff. I think some of the sequencing, some of the coaching could be improved for him, but I think overall pretty good. But yeah, the winter meetings are in what?
Brett Cecil with St. Louis, by the way. I know that was a guy that people certainly wanted the Cubs to at least think about.
Right, 4 years, $30 million. And that reminds me, the Marlins apparently have talked to Travis Wood's camp about a deal. And so, like we were speculating last week, it looks like Travis Wood is getting interest as a starting pitcher. So I doubt we see Wood back. Nothing in the Cahill market yet. Who knows? We could actually see Cahill coming back. So I know he didn't have the best year.
And we haven't seen really nothing on the Fowler front. Although, you know, it's certain. And I tweeted this morning, but it really, you know, I would love for him to stay here. But
It's hard to sort out all the dominoes.
Well, it is, and it's also, but you know, just to see these articles where they're referring to him as, you know, the big fish or highly sought after, this, that, and the other. It's I'm, you know, quite happy about that.
Right.
He really deserves it from a baseball player perspective and as a person. And, you know, especially for a guy who said over and over again that he was going to bet on himself. You know, he's just one of those guys who, when you read those headlines, you know, you certainly want him to stay, but you're very happy and, you know, in some weird sense, proud of him, you know, like he's our son, you know,
right.
You know, just to have that being written about him and knowing that he's, you know, going to get what he deserves. So, I do think it's interesting. I don't know if we talked about this last time that he, you know, I think he mentioned that he was looking for a 4-year deal, which is certainly closer to, you know, what the Cubs would be open to. I think, you know, obviously if he comes out and says he's looking for a 6 or 7 year deal, that kind of knocks us out right away. I don't know that we would. No, I know that, but I'm just saying, obviously hearing them say that it's like, okay, well, yeah. At least that's closer to reasonable. You know, if you're the Cubs, it's all right. That's reasonable. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I would expect him to go elsewhere. And as long as it's not St. Louis, I'll be very happy for him.
Right.
But
I think this would be the offseason for the Dodgers and for the Astros. We saw, I don't know if you saw this, Corey, but Brian McCann traded to the Astros. Josh Reddick signed. And this is perfect.
Yeah, I like that move.
Yeah,
I have mixed feelings on McCann, but
right. But Josh Reddick
lays
the foundation for what a Fowler contract might look like. Josh mm-hmm. Reddick got 4 years for $52 million. I think you and I would be confident to say that Fowler is probably more valuable than Reddick.
Yeah,
doesn't have platoon splits. Play center field. Should age pretty well. One of the best plate disciplined players in all of baseball. So if Reddick got $52 million, I would imagine, let's see, that's what, a little over 13, $14 million a year. I would imagine probably Fowler getting around $15 to $17 million a year for 4 years.
We can put it this way, that Dex is going to be able, not that he couldn't already, but he's going to be able to buy as many pairs of Jordans as his heart can possibly handle. Mm-hmm. So also that one, just a side note, if you didn't watch the video that, I think he posted it, but it might have been his wife who posted it. The video of him opening the Space Jam Jordan box that Nike sent him is just, man. I mean, if you're looking for a heartwarming moment,
I have not
the
seen
excitement
it.
Because you're Brent, you know, and this is something.
Here we go.
I don't want to get on that. I don't want to get on
go.
That. Brendan is the kind of person who. I assume most of our listeners saw the video the other day of Anthony Rizzo playing the piano while his dad is playing the drums. And Brendan is just the kind of guy who will send that to you like 3 days later and say, man, this is really funny. And sometimes I'd bite my tongue and just say, yeah, haha, it was. But other times I'd be like, yeah, Brendan, everybody saw this like 4 days ago, man.
That was literally like 5 hours after he posted it on his Instagram.
I'm just saying, Brendan is a little slow on the uptake.
It surprised me
that he hasn't seen the Dexter Fowler shoe video. But check that one out. He's opening up this like box that has these new or the re-release of the Space Jam Michael Jordan shoes, and just the level of excitement for you know a grown man with. You know, all the money in the world really is just amazing. He is so excited about these shoes. One point he lets out kind of like a shriek almost. but yeah, you know, it's just, you know, it's why everybody loves Dex. He's just a great guy. He's just having fun. And hopefully he gets a nice chunk of change and doesn't affect what the Cubs are doing. Although he couldn't really sign anywhere. I assume maybe he's thinking of signing out of the NL because that belongs to us for...
Just don't go to St. Louis for the life of
God. I know, really. I think that's what everybody's thinking. I do think it would be amusing to watch them play against each other. I think I tweeted this at one point, but, you know, Dex getting on base in a Cardinal uniform and then the antics Rizzo would have over at first base, I think might be worth it. But, yeah, let's just defer.
He can do that on a different team. I don't need to
see him. Literally anywhere else. Yeah. I would be fine with. So.
Cool. Well, we'll wrap up there. Going forward, we'll obviously keep you up to date with what's going on in the off season as moves are made. But for now, that's all we got for you, Corey. Any last words? And don't say no, and then go off on a 5-minute tangent. So what do you got?
Wow, well now I'm really on the spot.
Do you have nothing?
No, I mean I'll just end with it. I'm back in LA now, so I had the ability. I'll post it, maybe on Twitter or something, but it was cool to go up to my room and where most of my Cub memorabilia is and hold the ticket from Game 7 of the National League Championship Series in 2003. Which I still have in my room, and it is now properly placed next to the ticket from
I'm getting goosebumps.
Game 6 of the NLCS in Chicago and Game 7 of the World Series in Cleveland, and just a very fascinating, and it's just one of those things where it's like they're just three pieces of paper, but. To kind of see them next to each other is really something, and to think about all the times that I've looked at that one from 2003 and just had the worst thoughts and feelings about it, to finally be holding the correct one was pretty cool. And but yeah, no, I'm in full enjoyment mode. There's really nothing that. There's just nothing to do anymore, really. I just don't really care about anything. They won the World Series, so it's all over as far as I'm concerned. Really, anything can happen at this point. And I know I said it last week, but it's like everybody's so worked up about this election stuff. I'm like, yeah, all right, whatever.
The Cubs won the
I
World
think they're
Series.
reshowing the game against the Dodgers on the MLB Network tonight. But yeah, the election.
I actually want to ask you a question, Corey, because
Yeah.
I can't find it anywhere. You know that special WGN it aired, Fly the W with Lancaster. Do you know where I can find that? Like,
I don't. I
I
can poke
cannot
around on
find it
the internet.
anywhere. If
If
you are,
anybody knows,
please,
shoot
please, please.
me.
I've been seriously trying to find that for the past 2 weeks. So if you find that, just like tweet at me. I would love that.
But my last note, and then I'll be done, is in case anyone was wondering, anybody, I don't know where our listeners come to us from. I assume mostly the Illinois area, but. If anyone was wondering, is it satisfying to wear a Cubs World Series or pennant shirt in Los
It's
Angeles?
scary. It's
The
scary.
answer is a resounding yes. It's a little frightening, sure, but it is, the satisfaction level is very high, very high. So, in case you were unsure of what that might be like, I can tell you firsthand. It's great. So if
I
you
can
were
attest
planning
to
a trip
that.
to LA, bring all your Cubs stuff
If
and
you are in downtown Los Angeles and you see anyone walk on the streets with a Cubs World Series hat, that is 100% me. So if you see someone like that, just wave, because that will be me. Anyway, so what Corey was saying is enjoy the World Series, even though the election has probably stressed out a lot of people. Who cares, right? The Cubs win the World Series, I guess. But on that note, we'll talk to you guys soon.